Well, cancer is never a pleasant topic to discuss, but sadly, it's a condition that, frankly, many of us and also, unfortunately, many of our pets will deal with in the lifetime. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, visiting with two veterinary oncologists today, and they will be sharing some really important information about not only about what treatment options are available, but the importance of good communication between the veterinarian and the pet owner as well. When you have a pet with cancer, it's a tough time. I can tell you from experience. I have a kitty that had cancer, and you know, the results in the end weren't all that good. So, Dr. Timothy Stein, one of our guests today, is assistant professor in medical oncology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. Dr. Stein, thank you for coming by and being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And just as well, Dr. Ruth Ann Chun is associate dean for clinical affairs and directs the UW Veterinary Care, and she's a clinical professor of oncology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. And Dr. Chun, great to have you with us as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Well, how often within cats and dogs? I mean, is cancer a fairly, unfortunately, common occurrence?
I think, unfortunately, it's more common than we would like to see it, than any of us would like to see it. I think I just read a statistic that in dogs over the age of two, it's probably one of the leading causes of death in our canine companions. Probably not quite as high within cats, but still quite high.
When we look at populations of people versus dogs versus cats, the incidence of cancer in those three populations is very similar, unfortunately.
And it's really a sad. So that beyond the age of two, you kind of, not necessarily that they're all going to have cancer, but that it's
correct. It's one of the leading causes of death in the dogs, and I think probably for the under the age of two, we're worried about hitting by cars, running out in roads, other health
sure.
problems.
Infectious
but the
disease.
Older, well, typically it's the older populations of our cats and dogs that we're seeing.
And the types of cancer that are most common, dogs, let's say? Or
so in dogs, probably one of the most common cancers that we see is one called lymphoma.
Yeah.
And that's one that affects multiple lymph nodes in those animals. Skin tumors are also pretty common, so mast cell tumors.
And kitties, cats?
Cats we'll see some oral tumors in the mouth, so we'll see what's called squamous cell carcinoma, but we will also see some skin tumors and then also some kind of tumors that occur underneath the skin called sarcomas in cats.
Yeah. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. As you listen, have you dealt with a cancer diagnosis with your pet? I hope you'll tell us about your experiences. Maybe you have questions to share. Maybe you have a pet that's dealing with cancer right now. I know Dr. Chun and Dr. Stein are happy to offer advice and support for you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I mentioned communication and the importance of communication, and I think one of the areas of interest that you have, Dr. Chun, is this improving communication between the veterinarian and the pet owner. And why focus on that?
Well, clear communication so that people understand what's happening with their animal and understand what their options even are is so important. And veterinarians go to school for years to learn a specific language and to learn the right vocabulary. And then when we turn around and try and communicate with our clients, we have to undo all of that and be able to talk clearly and compassionately. We're in veterinary medicine because we love animals, and yet we have to be able to effectively communicate with our people.
How does the communication break down, or what? How?
I think people get so focused on knowledge, figuring out what's wrong and fixing it, that we want to help that animal, and we forget how do we effectively communicate what needs to happen to that animal, to its person. That person is why that animal is here, and that's key. And I think many young veterinarians especially get wrapped up in the, I want to find out what's wrong and I want to fix it, and they kind of forget the step of communicating clearly and empathically with the client.
And when that happens, I guess then the pet owner may not feel like they're, he or she is being heard.
That's exactly right. And it may be that the veterinarian says something that they think is very clear, and the client has a very different perception of what happened, and recognizing that happens. So you need, as a veterinarian, to make sure, does my client understand what I'm saying? So that to avoid those types of problems.
So what do you recommend from the owner's point of view when something like that happens?
So stop and check in and say, don't be afraid to say, boy, I'm not sure what you're talking
what
about.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, and we train our students to check in with their clients, but again, people get so wrapped up in, well, I want to figure out what's wrong and I want to fix it. So clients definitely need to kind of stand up and say, I'm not sure what you're talking about.
So from the client's point of view, the client just needs to be honest and just say, hey, I don't understand what you're talking about here.
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, the veterinarian needs to say, you know, what can I do to make this clearly understandable to anyone?
Yes, it's a two-way street. And I think the veterinarian is the one that really needs to take responsibility for that. But if the client doesn't understand, then they
the client should speak up.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Darren in Madison has a question. Hi, Darren. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. It's a great show, as always. And I just had a question about if your guest had any knowledge about why cancer is just such an extremely prevalent thing. I mean, with dogs in particular, I've had dogs growing up. I have a dog now who's 12, and I guess I just wonder why it's almost an expected and common thing that dogs get cancer so often. And you know, what if you have any kind of guesses as to what might be any underlying or perhaps systemic causes?
Sure. Thanks for calling, Dr. Stein. You want to start?
Sure, I'll take a crack. So that's a great question, and we're asked that quite frequently in people, you know, looking at, compared to the past, how much more frequently maybe we're diagnosing cancer in our pets. And I think there's a number of different reasons this might be occurring. One is our pets are probably living longer lives due to better preventative care, you know, annual checkups. They're living longer lives, and so they're probably more at risk for developing cancer types. I also think there's more of an interest in from the owners and our clients in pursuing, you know, what is this lump that my dog has or a cat has, and seeking out an answer for that. So I'm not sure, you know, if the actual prevalence or frequency is actually increasing, but we are probably diagnosing it more often and maybe treating it more often because there's more options available.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, why might, you know, the number of cancer cases be increasing. There's a lot of factors that go into cancer development. There's environmental factors. There's genetic factors that will go into cancer developing. And with a lot of dog breeds, you know, there's a lot of breeding going on to select for traits that we enjoy. And unfortunately, sometimes when we select for those traits that we enjoy, they may also come with some other undesirable traits. And so there's some genetics at play here.
Yeah, there are some dog breeds, for example, aren't there, Dr. Chen, that...
There are, unfortunately, some dog breeds that are more likely to develop cancers, and golden retrievers are probably one of my favorite breeds, and yet we see them very, very commonly developing cancers, and other breeds that we know are predisposed to specific types of cancers. For example, boxers or pugs are more likely to get mast cell tumors in their skin. So we, for sure, are seeing certain types of breeds that are more likely to have cancer.
Mm. And Darren, again, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Susie at Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for this dialogue. You know, I was very privileged in being able to work at a university where they had a vet tech program, and I learned a lot from the veterinarians there. And the number one thing I learned from them is that you really need to let the veterinarian diagnose, because we have a Vizsla mix. He's a Vizsla Pomeranian and Beagle. Don't ask me how that happened, but he had some lumps and bumps, and we were getting really concerned, and we took him into his vet, and his vet said, you know, look, he's just got some ingrown hairs and a little allergy going on, and it wasn't cancer at all. So don't worry yourself unnecessarily. I guess my message is go to the vet and figure out what it is.
Yeah. I think those are good points, Dr. Chen.
Yeah, those are awesome points. And really, you know, you can find a lump, and certainly we see it's easy to find those skin lumps or sometimes the oral tumor. But to be able to figure out what it is, a veterinarian should be very well equipped to do that. And with a, sometimes they'll recommend doing a very simple, straightforward test called a needle aspirate. And it's quick. It's easier even than getting a vaccine. And it usually gets you an answer is, do I need to worry about this?
Thanks again, Susie. Jennifer and Dane, your turn. Hi, Jen. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, you bet. I'm very happy to hear as well as the dialogue going on. I've been through my past two dogs, a German Shepherd and also a black lab, both passed away from cancer. So familiar with the dialogue, I guess. My question is regarding preventative care. Is there anything, while the dog is young, diet versus even vitamins that are proven to help reduce risk of cancer, or is it strictly more genetic?
Okay, what do you think, Dr. Stein?
Well, that's a great question, and we're asked that very frequently. And I don't think there is enough evidence out there to suggest one diet over another is going to prevent cancer. So we typically recommend, you know, a balanced diet for all these pets, and going in annually to your veterinarian, having your dog checked out, any new lumps or bumps. But unfortunately, I think there's a lot of products out there being marketed as a true cancer preventative, and I don't think there's probably enough evidence to really recommend one of those products at this point.
Yeah.
And we see that in humans as well, that, you know, there's the hot new vitamin that everybody should be taking, and then years later they say, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
Early detection is the big issue.
Okay.
Sorry about your dogs.
Oh, no, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And John and Madison, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, the World Health Organization has changed its mind, and they're now saying that Roundup, the weed killer put out by Monsanto, is likely carcinogenic for humans based on causing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in rats and mice. And I'm just wondering, since everybody uses Roundup on their yards, in your mind, is this a risk for dogs? And I just wondered, does anybody know has the incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma been increasing for pets over the last 40 years like it has for humans?
Okay, thanks for calling.
That's a great question. And I think when we look at incidence of cancer in dogs, we always have to think about, well, are more and more people bringing their dogs to the vet? So it's being reported more. So it's hard to really truly know. Is it truly increasing frequency, or are just more people bringing their dogs in for a diagnosis? So that part of the question is a tough one to answer. Certainly 2,4-D, which is one of the compounds within some herbicides, has been associated with cancer.
Mm-hmm. And we'll bring that up and talk a little bit more. We need to take a quick look at the news, weather, and then we will be back with our guests in just a few minutes. You stay with us. Cancer is never a pleasant topic to talk about. Sadly, it's a condition that many of us and our pets are going to deal with in our lifetime. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visiting today with Dr. Timothy Stein, Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Ruth Ann Chan, thank you so much. She's an Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs. She directs the UW Veterinary Care Center. She's Clinical Professor of Oncology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And great to have you with us, Dr. Chan. Thank you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And callers online, by the way, if you want to join in, we do have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Before our break, a caller had asked about, really got into the topic of herbicides. And you were saying, Dr. Chun, that 2,4-D is an example of an herbicide that can create cancer.
So it certainly
or lead
people,
to.
Yes, and people, it's the link is pretty strong, especially for individuals that used to actually walk through the field spraying this herbicide on agriculture, and that was a big issue. We do know from studies that have looked at the presence of 2,4-D in lawns that it can be there for many, many years, even long after it was sprayed. So it's certainly a concern. Mm-hmm. It's not definitively been shown in dogs that that's a carcinogen. One worries.
Yeah,
certainly.
Okay, yeah, but you think, yeah, it's something to really think about before you're applying it to your lawns. Yeah, absolutely. We had a Facebook, a nice Facebook comment from Cheryl, who says Dr. Chun is top in her field looking at golden retriever health. Thanks so much for your work, especially on golden retriever lymphosarcomas.
It's a very kind comment, and golden retrievers are lovely, lovely dogs. They deserve better than getting cancer all the time.
So you've worked on, so this is a research area of interest for you.
Lymphoma, certainly lymphosarcoma, is a research interest, and there's a large multi-institutional study going on looking at golden retriever health specifically, and we at the vet school are part of that multi-institutional study.
Oh, that's really wonderful. So you're looking at what causes it how to treat it, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's actually a lifetime study of golden retrievers and their health issues.
Yeah, it's a really exciting study that, as Dr. Chun had said, is a multi-institutional study that the Morris Animal Foundation has really been supporting in terms of gathering data and samples from golden retrievers throughout the course of their entire life so we can better understand some of the disease processes that they get and hopefully in turn improve diagnostics and treatment options.
Are you looking at the certain genes that are within a golden, or is it...
That will be part of what they're assessing. So they are taking cheek swabs and tissue samples when biopsies are done. Mm-hmm. And so there will be a lot of information that comes out of that study.
Well, that's going to be really... want to be one of the first programs to have you guys on to talk about some findings from that, because there's a lot of interest among our listeners, for sure.
Well, and certainly when we look at dogs with cancer, it's a naturally occurring disease, just like it is in people. And there's so much that can be learned directly from dogs and shared to people, and sometimes the other way as well.
We have just thinking now about a physician that a geneticist that we had on the show just a couple of weeks ago, who has doing some fantastic work in detection of cancer, and has a new system, developed something now that can detect cancer in humans much, much earlier than has been the case in the past, and I think for 52 different cancers. And I'm just wondering, you might want to get in touch with that person.
That would be terrific, to be able to catch cancer, you know, at its earliest possible point. And there are definitely a lot of studies ongoing to try and find, you know, samples or something that we can either detect on a blood test or even, you know, some people's saliva, changes that we could detect something early enough. We're not quite there, obviously, on the veterinary side, but that's exciting news to hear.
Yeah, and I'm not giving it what it's worth, you know, really what the kind of attention I should, but I know there was one cancer, a couple of cancers in particular, that are almost impossible to detect early, and then when they do detect it, it's already too late, and this new procedure does identify it. So, something to think about. And I'm across, you guys work across human, pet. I know a lot of times I've heard Dr. Sawchuk say, okay, well, we've used this for treating humans, and we also can now use it for treating pets.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have, one of the things that we do at the school, we have clinical trials for animals with cancer, and some of those actually are trials looking at drugs that might be of utility in people as well as in animals.
So it works the other way, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Scott and Shano, your turn. Hi, Scott. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I know that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, golden retrievers, there's a lot of interest. They have some health issues. And most species have particular, or most breeds, rather, of dogs have specific health issues that tend to crop up and be endemic in that breed. I have two Springer Poodle crosses. I'm allergic to dogs, but love them, and so that solves the problem because they're hypoallergenic and they don't shed. But I'm wondering if you guys are familiar enough with that particular cross. There's a lot of them out there now, I think, that you could give me any advice on anything I need to keep my eye open for as to whether they have any particular health issues being mixed breeds.
Yeah.
So with the kind of the Springer Doodles in particular, I think some of these kind of the hybrid crosses, the Doodle crosses, which are terrific for people who are, you know, either allergic to regular dog hair or you know, whatnot. I think some of these crosses are so new, we probably don't really know, you know, as far as the types of tumors that they might encounter in those breeds, that we just don't know. We haven't seen enough of those types of breeds of dogs to really say for sure. And so it kind of just goes back to, you know, being pretty vigilant or aware of any, you know, new lumps or bumps that occurs on a, you know, just because it's a Springer noodle doesn't mean it wouldn't have a tumor develop, or it doesn't necessarily mean it will, but having those lumps or bumps checked out by their veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thanks very much for calling. And, you know, I've often thought about this. You know, you think about sometimes you've got dogs that have crossbred or other kinds of animals that crossbreed, they wind up as hardier and better able to withstand
absolutely
some of these problems.
Yeah, I think that there's potential there that they would hopefully inherit the positive
of both,
aspects,
yeah,
of both breeds.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, thanks. Joan in West Salem, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi to you guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, this is just kind of a comment to keep an eye out, for people to keep an eye out for. Long story short, we took in a stray cat that we had seen in our yard with a large growth on its leg, large and very gross. Took it to the vet. The vet said it was a cancerous tumor. We would need to amputate the leg. I got a second opinion from another vet. They were absolutely amazing. They took a biopsy, and here it was an infected wart. Mm-hmm. Through months and months of pure agony with this cat, we were able to save the leg, heal the wound. And I guess my comment is to get a second opinion, because it was not a cancerous tumor, and we were able to save the cat and save the leg, and he had a wonderful life after that.
Well, that's great news. And Dr. Chen, you're going to agree with that, aren't you?
Absolutely. If there is question about a diagnosis, if it's something like, wow, we've only seen one of these ever before, a second opinion never hurts. And I think that professionals should be open to that as well, to say, mm-hmm, well, yeah, it is odd.
Yeah, let somebody else take a look at it as well. Thanks, Joan. Good advice. Fred in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Fred.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Labrador, black Labrador, 10 years old, who's going to go through sarcoma front leg surgery on Friday to remove a growth. And I'm wondering about the recurrence rate. I've had two opinions. One wanted to do some really radical surgery that involved skin grafting and everything else. The surgery I decided on was less invasive, and they'll just try to remove as much of the growth as they can. So I'm wondering about recurrence. And my second question is kind of an alternative medicine idea. I've heard of a product called Mengelstein juice. Those are my two parts of my question.
Sure. Okay.
I'll start with the second part first. The mangosteen juice, I guess I'm not familiar with that, so I'm not sure what type of preventative or effects that would have. So I'm not sure there. But I do tend to take a lot of some of these supplemental things with a little bit of grain of salt in terms of not knowing what truly to expect as far as good controlled studies that have been done with them. And then the first part of the question about the sarcoma and the recurrence rate, I think that's very difficult to address without, you know, what they're going to need to do is submit that tissue that's removed to a pathologist and have them evaluate or look at that tissue to see, are the margins of the surgery, are there any tumor cells there? And the more of a normal margin that we can get, probably the better chance we have of not having recurrence there.
It was classified as a grade one.
Okay. So grade ones tend to be pretty good news. And if they've got clean surgical margins at that surgery site, the likelihood of recurrence is probably pretty low with that.
The only downside to that is that if it's a very large mass and they took a very small biopsy initially, that may not have been a representative sample. So that would be the only kind of voice inside my head saying, oh, we better be careful.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Mangosteen juice. Well, mangoes, obviously, are probably part of it. The steen part, or maybe not. Judith's telling me it's a totally different fruit, and I never heard of it. So I should keep my mouth shut.
Well, I'm still feeling burned by the whole soy protein, you know. Yeah. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that was the thing to do, and now they're saying, oh, people shouldn't be doing it at all.
Yeah. Julie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi. This is really a timely discussion for me. I have a boxer who was just out of surgery with his second mast cell tumor. The first one 2 months ago was a grade one, and all edges of the tumor removal were all clear. Now this one came back, and I mean, no kidding, the thing was so small, but it came back according to the new standards of staging or grading, I guess, the two level, and it came back as a high grade. And I forget the person's name, Cooler or somebody like that, that's got this two staging now.
People.
And anyway, it also has a high mitotic level. It's a 9 out of 10, but the margins were all clear in this. And so I'm just wondering what kind of a prognosis, I mean, how do we detect if it's gone beyond this area that was removed because of it being a high grade? Is that typical that it's in the lymph nodes? And I don't know. It's just scary.
Okay.
So that's a good question. And I guess there's a few other questions that we would probably ask. And one is, was that tumor at the same site that had been removed previously, or is this a different site?
No, it's okay. It's not at all. Okay. The first one was in the axilla, okay. And then this last one was on his right thigh.
Okay. And then the second thing that we probably bring up and discuss would be staging. So making sure that we don't see evidence of this mast cell tumor anywhere else in the boxer. And that typically involves aspirating those lymph nodes, as you had mentioned, but also maybe performing an abdominal ultrasound. Given that this was a higher grade tumor, we know that they are perhaps there's more of a chance that they could spread to other areas, and they like to go to livers or spleens, and we can look at those with an ultrasound and maybe aspirate some of those areas, as well as maybe a chest x-ray.
How can you, you know, with the cells being so small, how can you see these with an ultrasound?
So that's a very good question. And what would probably need to be done is they'd need to take an aspirate of the liver or the spleen if they think things are looking abnormal. So you wouldn't be able to say with an ultrasound, yes, it looks like there's a spleen or liver or lymph node involvement without taking some cells out of there.
And to add to that, sometimes the when tumors are inside an organ, they actually have different ultrasound properties than the normal organ itself. And so sometimes you will actually see it as a nodule on the spleen or on the liver. And what Dr. Stein is saying about mast cell tumors in particular is that they can be more infiltrative, meaning they're more throughout the entire organ and not forming a mass per se there.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah, it's just having some past history and as far as in nursing and all, it's like pelvic ultrasounds, you know, they're transvaginal, so you have a better option to see things in the pelvis, but obviously you can't do that for the abdomen.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, thank you, Julie, for calling, and good luck for you and for your pet. I appreciate your call very much. I want to give Mary in Sleepy Hollow, Illinois, a chance to join us. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. We had a chocolate lab, beautiful animal, who died at a young age of 7 2 years ago from lymphoma sarcoma. He went really, really quick. But what I was wondering, since we live in a town that you cannot have fences, and we just have the invisible fence, and of course, there's tons of deer roaming through the yard and eating apples from the apple tree. Well, he started taking the liking to deer poop and started eating it. Well, I would drag him in the house, and we even would put the electric fence around the apple tree to keep him out of there and to keep from eating the apples. But it's like because he would just gorge himself on the apples, but then and of course, the deer would eat the apples, and then they would drop their poop, and so he started eating that. And I would drag him in the house and brush his teeth. And do you think that could have caused the sarcoma?
I don't think so. It's sadly, in wild dogs, deer poop is probably part of their natural diet, and it's not one of the things that I would be concerned about as far as carcinogens. I'd be more worried about herbicides in the lawn than I would be about deer poop.
And I did talk to when we started having someone taking care of our lawn and stuff, and we opted for the natural stuff to put down on the lawn. Yeah, it took a little longer to get the lawn in shape, but he assured us that there was nothing bad in there and showed me everything. So
there you go. Thank you so much for calling, Mary. I appreciate your call. Wayne and Grand Marsh, your turn. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We just lost my dog, Tan Man, last Saturday, and we had spent the last 6 months at the UW fighting cancer with him. And Dr. Mary Miller and that was helping us. And what I want to point out is about early any of those bumps and humps and stuff that you see on your dog. The minute you find them, get them aspirated. Because that could have gave us an extra 3 months to fight the cancer if we'd have done that and insisted instead of hearing this hair follicle thing. And I heard someone earlier say the same thing. So I just want to point out, any lumps, any bumps, test them as soon as possible. It only costs a person $30 to $60. Know your dog's body. Rub them, love them, test.
Good points.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Wayne, for calling in. And you know, we're all really, really sad to hear about Tan Man and recall treating him.
Yeah, that's very. But so if you see something, don't just assume it's not going to be a problem. Get in right away.
And it's one of those things where even just by feeling it, that's not going to give you a specific answer. So that aspirate is an important part of it. Thanks for that reminder.
Lois in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Chun.
Hi.
This is Jack's mom, Lois, from Wausau.
Yeah, hi.
I just wanted to tell everyone about the wonderful experience I had with you at the vet school. I took my beloved lab in. He was 8 at the time and was fortunate enough to be assigned to Dr. Chun, and we treated Jack for 3 years with chemo and radiation, and he had a good quality of life for 3 years, and then when he was 11, our luck ran out, but I think of you often, Dr. Chun, and getting emotional again, I hope you're well, and I think about you often.
Well, Jack was a wonderful dog, and he had such wonderful people, and thank you. Thank you so much for calling.
Lois, thank you very much for calling. I really appreciate your call and your comments. We often get these calls near the end of these shows for some reason, and I tear up practically every time. An email from Susan wondered, she said, I'm in favor of palliative care for people. How about it for dogs?
There are palliative care options that are available for dogs and cats with certain types of cancers, and I guess one that comes to mind particularly is for bone cancers, using radiation therapy in terms of trying to palliate any discomfort that's associated with bone pain in dogs. But there's a lot of other medical management options available. We've got an acupuncture department or service at the veterinary school that will do some palliative care with that as well. And so there definitely are options because, you know, at the end of the day, that's why we keep our cats and dogs around, is because we make them happy. And so trying to control any discomfort they might be in is a good thing.
And we had John and Mason wondered about indoor smoking by owners. Is that a cancer risk or a health risk for pets, especially maybe the particles setting on fur, you know, and then you're licking your fur and all that?
Yeah, there probably is an association or an increase in the risk of certain forms of cancer that in pets that are exposed to kind of that secondhand smoke. And John's right in terms of the particulate matter setting on that fur and then them cleaning themselves. There is an increased perhaps exposure to some of those potential carcinogens, especially in cats with like oral squamous cell carcinoma. There's an increased risk associated with kind of secondhand smoke and those.
Well, this has been a marvelous show. I've learned a lot myself, and I want to thank you both so much for coming today, and I hope we can have you back and just do this again. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did as well. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We'll be happy to come back anytime.
That's wonderful. Our guests today, Dr. Ruth Ann Chung, Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs, Director of the UW Vet Care, and clinical professor of oncology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the UW, and also Dr. Tim Stein, who, a PhD, assistant professor of medical oncology at the School of Veterinary Medicine. We ought to be proud of our School of Veterinary Medicine. They do really wonderful work, not only taking care of your pets and mine, but also the wonderful research that goes on there that really helps in the long run for so many of us who own pets. I thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.